Welcome to WeAreTechnology.com's User Friendly 2.0 with host Bill Sickens, Technology Architect.
And this is User Friendly 2.0. As always, I am your host, Bill Sickens. Joining me, my co-host Bill and Gretchen. Welcome to this week's show.
Hello there.
So I got to ask the question that's on everybody's mind. Probably not, but on my mind. How was your Halloween?
Went pretty well.
It was busy. Lots of kids. But I didn't answer the door because I took the cheater method and put a bowl out there and let the camera watch them.
Did they steal your bowl?
No, I've never had someone steal the bowl or the bag. I've put a bag out before. And I usually give instructions, you know, happy Halloween, please take one, you know.
So the neighbor here, the reason I bring it up, the neighbor by where I live did that. She is elderly and didn't want to answer the door. Uh-huh. Came out next morning to find the candy, the bowl, and the table it was sitting on were gone.
Really?
Jeez.
They took the table?
They took the table. And she's just like, okay, whatever. But
okay. Anyway,
outside of that, we're now through Halloween and time to start thinking about Thanksgiving, if you can believe it. We're going to be covering some stuff, including kitchen gadgets for Thanksgiving here in a couple of weeks. And, you know, from that end, it's amazing to see all the new stuff that's out there. I would say about 90% of it is kind of kitsch. You want to avoid it, but there are some cool things. So we'll be getting into that. But this week, after the news, we're going to be taking on Android versus iPhone. Which one is better? And I can hear people typing the comments now. So send them in. We'll talk about that a little later in the show.
Yeah.
All right, let's go ahead and get through our news. What do we have this week?
All right, coming to you now from Steam, Malware. So explain this to me.
I don't think I want that game.
No.
Are you destroying the malware with the game? That'd be cool.
Well, that would probably be okay, you know. But it's interesting to see this because it's kind of, they're bad guys are trying these things everywhere, and they put up a game on Steam. Obviously, that's what you would do there. And when you download it, it's actually Windows malware. So, you know, the idea of this happening, I can't say comes to me as a shock, mainly because I think it's more into what I would have to say is that just this hasn't happened before.
Mm-hmm.
The Steam, the way it's set up, is indie publishers, or really anyone, but indie publishers mainly can publish games. You know, it's a really cool site, and anybody that's a gamer that does video games has probably heard of it, if not used it. And from that standpoint, it's a good resource to have, but it is also known that the juring of the software going up there wasn't necessarily looked at that closely. So a hacker decided to exploit this and threw up some software that was malware for Windows and got a number of downloads in it before it got caught. They've added it to Windows Defender and all these things now to block it, as has Steam. But just something to think about, you know, and especially on Windows computers, because that's where most of the malware is pointed. It does exist for Apple and, you know, Android, iPhone, and all of that too. But primarily you see it on Windows. And one thing that you can do, especially if you're getting software from a site that is even known like Steam, or certainly one that's not so well known, is there's a way to set up a sandbox in your Windows environment and then run it there, see if it's okay, but it's blocked from everything else. And that kind of thing is probably a good idea. It's an extra step, but certainly can save you a lot of hassle of having to reload or de-encrypt your computer or something when you get malware and now you can't get access to your stuff.
You know, you are going to get a question. How do I find a sandbox location on my computer?
Is that question going to come from you?
Well, it could, but I bet you some of the listeners are going, what?
I'll tell you what, I think you're absolutely accurate in that, and I think it's a valid thing to anticipate. So let's do this. Next week, we're going to be doing our fall Q&A, so let's make sure we have that question in the queue.
All right. New Robert Downey Jr. Dr. Doom suit HD photos reveal two exciting details.
Yes, I think the suit is cool. If you haven't seen a picture of this, check it out. Somebody really did a nice job on the costume. And one of the concerns, you know, Robert Downey Jr., of course, played Iron Man, and he's coming back into the same universe as a different character. But from looking at this and the way that they're doing it, I think it's going to work. And then the other thing is the two interesting things that you're talking about there are the logos on his suit. One is Thor's hammer, and the other one is Captain America. So it's just kind of a shout out to that too, which is a cool thing. And, you know, to see how that all ties together. But I really have to say, I like the way they did his suit. It just looks cool. I wouldn't mind a suit like that just to wear to work.
Huh. I've got to see it then. All right. NASA's supersonic jet finally takes off for its first super fast, super quiet flight.
Yeah, so it's interesting. Some may remember the Concorde, which was a supersonic jet that did passenger service, was taken out of use just mainly because of maintenance costs and that type of a thing. But the idea of a supersonic aircraft is really nothing new. But what's cool about this one is there's no sonic boom. That's the quiet part. So it's able to enter the bypass the sound barrier and not have the big bang that you hear. So just for the record, that's 767 miles per hour, give or take, when you hit that. So again, interesting technology. You know, the one thing I have to ask about this kind of stuff is, are they planning to bring back supersonic aviation? It wasn't that it was unsafe. It was just the maintenance of these type of planes and stuff made it not worthwhile to compete. But it'd be kind of fun if you could fly to, you know, to Europe in an hour or something a little longer than that, but still.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought NASA's there were other Voyagers. Reasons why. I'm sorry. I thought there were other reasons why the supersonic plane went away.
Yeah, there are. And if we had more time, we'd dig into it. But the main one was actually the cost.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, Bill.
It's okay. NASA's Voyager spacecraft finds a blazing wall of fire at the edge of the solar system.
So I don't get why this is unusual. It makes sense that we'd have a firewall. We do for everything else.
I keep thinking of Star Trek.
The bad guys breach it, you know? Yeah.
No.
Yeah, that's the other thing that made me think of this. Yeah, yeah. And so this is kind of interesting. So NASA's Voyager 1 and 2 have gone out further than any other human-made object. They're both out in interstellar space now, and they're both still operating and beaming back information. And this wall of fire is kind of interesting because technically it's tens of thousands of degrees Kelvin, and just that's hot. You know, that's very hot. But the question that comes out of all of this is, well, if Voyager's going through that, wouldn't it burn up the spacecraft? And the answer is no, because of the amount of space that's out there. While the molecules are excited to that temperature, it's not dense enough to actually damage the spacecraft with the heat that exists. So kind of just an interesting way to look at the physics behind it. But beyond it begins what they call true interstellar space. It's almost there. And, you know, maybe we can get a hold of the Roswell Grays and see if they can put a new battery on them so that they can transmit a little bit longer.
You mean the Voyagers?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that'd be great.
So, you know, why not? All right.
Okay.
What else do we have?
All right. Amazon doesn't want AIs shopping on its site. At least that's what Comet says. And Comet is apparently not a dog.
No, it's an AI that is not allowed to evidently shop on Amazon's site. So a company called Perplexity has created the AI Comet. And the idea of this is that this AI is an assistant, and you can say, Comet, order me whatever off of Amazon, right? And it will go out there and do it. Well, Amazon's having problems with this, saying that, well, they don't get the right kind of feedback and they can't do the reviews. The real reason, in my opinion, is that if you bypass Amazon's what they call user experience, you're bypassing all of their ads, promotions, and everything else. And the AI doesn't care about all that. It's just going to go and order what you want. So they issued a cease and desist order to stop this from happening. That is still pending. But Amazon blocked Comet by a change to their software, and now Perplexity has upgraded Comet to be able to get around the block.
So what does Alexa think of all of this? Because wasn't she being asked to shop for people?
Oh, yeah, still does. But the thing of it is, again, you're looking at an AI that's employed by, and I'll use those terms, Amazon, wherever you want to go with that. But the thing of it is that there's a difference there, because Amazon considers that they have control over one, but not the other. And I think probably there is some truth to not being able to look up comparables and that kind of a thing. But at the end of the day, it's another example of this is the Fire TV stick. which is Amazon's smart TV adapter. Very good product. I like it. But they blocked out another number of applications that changed the way that it would boot up, because they wanted their commercials to be on the top of the screen in the front. And if something changes the user experience, it's not allowed on the platform. I think this is a similar idea. So,
okay.
Anyway, all right. So that being said, I'm going to throw this question out here and ask you, Android or Apple, which one is better? So where this topic idea comes from is we get your questions, and a lot of the ones that come in is that, you know, to what extent, maybe in one way or the other, does one do one thing better, another better? But the interesting thing about this is something that has really existed as long as computers have, is there seems to be this almost religion between people that like one or the other. And you saw that back with the Macintosh Windows days, you know, and way back in the day, Atari and Commodore, all this kind of stuff seems to continue to exist. Now, here in 2025, whether you're on a Macintosh or a PC, the files are interchangeable. You know, that didn't used to be the case. I mean, there was a time that if you created a file on your computer and you needed to share it with somebody and they didn't have the same system, or even maybe the same make but not the same model of the system, they couldn't read your disk, and there were no flash drives or anything at that point. So the other way was to transmit it over a 1200 baud modem, which was very painful. So in 2025, we are in a very different situation where your files, if you work in Word, as for example, on the Mac, you can open on the PC, that type of
thing. I had no idea. I didn't know they fixed this. It's been so long since I've been involved with that kind of graphics and stuff. So, yeah.
I'm glad that they have, because it was in the modern era, that wouldn't work, I don't think, anyway.
Yeah, get old.
You know, my Photoshop doesn't open on your Photoshop because I'm on Windows and you're on, you know, Mac OS, whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
And you know, just as a little aside on that, back in the 90s, there were actually hardware devices that were made that would go in your computer that would emulate the other one, mainly emulating in those days DOS on a Mac, so that you could read the files in that way. And this hardware was like $1,890 to buy. And you also had that for the Amiga computer, which was out at the time. You know, some of these old names I haven't thought of in a while. And, you know, so at that end, that's where all that comes from. And before we circle back to the phone, comparison here, I just want to remind you, don't copy that floppy. All right. Back out of the retro stuff, you have Android and you have iOS. You used to have the Windows Mobile, which has largely fallen behind the wayside. I don't even think the ecosystem still exists for it out there. So those are the two kinds of things you're going to get. And the question comes out, and it is a legitimate question, is one or the other better? And to look at that, you really need to consider what you're dealing with and what you want. So to explain it a little bit, you have two very different methods of building a computer. And a smartphone is a computer that does the same thing, sometimes more than your laptop and whatnot. And at the end of the day, you have one philosophy from Apple, which is very closed source. So you get in there and you have less applications. It's much harder to get your application onto the platform, that kind of a thing. It has to be reviewed and whatnot. But what that does end up doing is there's less of a chance of getting crappy applications or malware, that kind of a thing, because it is juried. And then the other thing that Apple has with that is, because they're the manufacturer of not only the software, but the hardware, all iPhones are made by Apple, you have an environment where you know it is going to work. Now, everything is very, I don't want to say basic, but kind of corporate almost, gray color, that kind of a thing. You can customize, but out of the box, that's what you're looking at. So if you want something that you're going to just grab and don't mind spending a lot of money for it, and it just works, that might be the type of thing. Now, the other side of this is Android, which I wouldn't say is 180 degrees different, because they do jury applications and stuff, but it's much easier to get onto Play Store and that type of a thing. If, in fact, the philosophy is if they find it objectionable later, they'll take it off. But as long as your app meets the requirements and gets through their AI, it probably will get onto the market. The other thing of it is on the Android side of it, there's many, many, many different manufacturers that can build the phones. And the history of it's different too, because in 2007, when the iPhone came out, iOS was built specifically for that purpose, to run the phone. Android was originally an operating system for digital cameras. It wasn't created by Google either. It was bought by them later on and then used for the operating system for the Android phones that we have now. So it didn't start out as a phone operating system. And the other side of it is since Google doesn't have control of the hardware ecosystem, it's kind of like Windows for all the different versions of the PCs that are out there. You have to have something that's going to work universally or as close to it as you can get. And there are inconsistencies, mainly because the updates are usually done by the manufacturer. So if you get a Samsung phone, you're going to have a different update rollout than if you have a Pixel or something else. So at the end of the day, you have that. However, since there's more competition, the prices of phones are lower. You can get a good quality product for not as much as you would pay for an iPhone. And you have a lot more access to being able to look at different things from different places. And at the point of this recording, there's some talk about them wanting to change it. I don't know if they will, but you can sideload apps. Back in my day, that was called installing software. You know, where it doesn't necessarily come out of the market. So trying to make a decision on which one is better, I don't think one is better. I think it's more purpose-driven and what you need it to be and what you want and what you can afford and that type of a thing. Now, I think all of us are Android. I know I am. Bill, Gretchen, you guys use Android or iPhone?
Android.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's because for me, Android was, because I worked with Windows applications or softwares when I was doing geological drafting. And AutoCAD and all that stuff did Windows. It wasn't on Apple products. Apple was like some of the more artistic stuff. And it was almost like they had two different professions or mind thinking to go with. And then as time has gone on, both sides have broadened. And I think that's been better. What do you think?
I would agree with you 100% on that, and having, you know, the opportunity, one drives the other. So when one gets innovation, you see it on the other. So that very much is a part of that kind of thing. If you just had one product out there, it would not be, in all likelihood, as advanced as we see our phones are today. So I'm going to throw this other question at you, Bill, because this is a question that comes in from a lot of our listeners. If you were given an opportunity to have comparable phones, so like say a Samsung Galaxy versus an iPhone, whatever the newest version of it is, and they were free, would you choose Apple at that point based on the price, or would you stick with Android?
I personally would stick with Android because I'm a customizer, and I've had an iPhone before for a work thing, and I've had an iPad. They're not as customizable as, say, an Android phone, and I'm a heavy customizer to, you know, what I want and how I want it to work and different ways like that.
So some of the things that you see on Android, like if you want your phone to look differently, you can download a theme and it'll change it. That kind of stuff is still, I think, what you're talking about, where you can really customize it. If you want to, you can sit down, make your own icons, make your own layout, all that kind of stuff. And that is definitely a big thing, where you'll see that many programmers, many people that create technology agree 100%, Bill, with what you just said on making that choice. And the funny thing about it is because from a business standpoint, Apple is probably a better idea, because your business IT department has one set of hardware they're maintaining, you know, the support for it and that kind of a thing, which on Apple's credit is generally a lot easier to get to than Android support. If you needed to do that, you can go online, get a lot of answers to things and that type of stuff. But at the end of the day, things like Apple Care and a phone number you can call might exist through a vendor like Samsung or something. But as far as the operating system itself goes, there isn't exactly that kind of ecosystem for help. You know, so your businesses are going to look at, hey, this is much easier to support.
Well, not only that, but it is because it is a closed system and it is less customizable. You know, you're going to be dealing with pretty much one system and one setup and one, your employees are not going to be able to mess with it too much.
It depends on the employee, I suppose. But yeah, it's definitely, you know, that would be the case. And I know it from even the Windows side of things. Back before I really started coding for many years, I did hardware support. And I had a couple of clients that were, you know, bigger, like Fortune 500 stuff, like Wells Fargo Bank was one of them, Norwest at the time, and stuff. And what you would see is an environment in these places where, yeah, it was on Windows, but they made sure that all of the hardware was the same, I mean, as much as possible. So it's like that same idea. They're only having to support one thing. And at the time, from a business standpoint for a computer operating system, you had Active Directory or Windows Server, you had Novell Network, if you want to go back a little bit more, and all of that. And then on the Apple side, you had AppleTalk, but they didn't really get the networking thing done for a number of years after they did on the PC, to an extent that it was, you know, stable and usable and something that you would see in a business environment. AppleTalk works. It just didn't have the adoption that you saw on the Ethernet side. Now everything uses Ethernet. But again, so you're absolutely right.
What you're saying is that the Windows Android environment is more flexible and a little more prone to having bad things happen. But the Apple side is less flexible and stiff, and they have less of the bad things happen, but there isn't that creative openness that you get with the other side. So it kind of evens out. You get some good things on one side and some bad things, and it evens out. It just depends on what's important to you.
Yeah.
I think that's a good way to sum it up. I really do, because that kind of a thing is what you're looking at from one to the other. Mm-hmm. But again, it begs the question, is one better? I don't think so.
No.
I think the use case like determines what you should use, but it's they both work. They both do the job. You know, you can get on the internet, you can download apps. I think you can still make phone calls. So, you know, it's no, but in all seriousness, and the thing of it is most platforms, the two platforms do offer most of the bigger apps. You know, you have Zoom on both of them, you have Discord on both of them, that kind of a thing. But there are some differences, and there are some things that are only available on one, but not on the other. And the other thing that I find interesting too about all of this is when you dig in a little bit deeper, it seems like there's always a premium when you deal with Apple products. Not only does the hardware cost more, but even getting a programmer to write code for it. If your average programmer today, makes $195 an hour writing code, there's going to be a premium on top of that if they're doing Apple most of the time. And it's because of having to deal with the process of going through and doing stuff. You can't even really test a lot of these things on real hardware without having a developer's kit and permission and all that kind of stuff. Whereas on Android, you just sideload it to the phone and you try it. There's virtual environments for both, and a lot of programmers will use that, but you do get to a point where you need to deal with real world hardware and that type of thing to see what works. So at the end of the day, that means that your software also costs more money. So again, it looks at the perspective, and it really has switched, because in the past, it was always Windows that was more for business. And now it's becoming the other way. Both do well. And Windows is hardly out of the running or anything like that, or even close. It's still very much the majority operating system that's used, you know, out there. But it is interesting to see how these things evolve and where it goes and what some of the real reasons are why on things are different. So let us know what you think. Send us your comments. Userfriendly.show is the place to do it. We will be back after the break. Welcome back. This is User Friendly 2.0. Userfriendly.show is your one stop to send us your questions, your comments, your ideas. Let us know what you think. And on the idea of review, we are going to go to the vault, James Sherwood, and talk Borderlands 4.
Welcome back to the vault. My name is James. I'll be your host today. And today we're going to talk about a new game just came out a little bit ago, Borderlands 4. Borderlands 4 is a RPG looter shooter, which means you're running around trying to collect the best gear you can, taking out enemies, but there's still a fair bit of story element to it. It can be a really fun game to play. It was released on September 11th, 2025. It was released on PlayStation, Xbox, and computer. There was some issues on day of release with computer release. It was crashing, stuttering. It was using way more resources than it was originally said that it was supposed to. They've released several patches for it. Not all of them have been the most successful. I was playing it on Xbox and had very few problems with it. It is also a cross-play enabled game. What that means is if one of you is playing on PC, another person is playing on Xbox, another person's playing on PlayStation, you can still all line up and play on the same game. One of the neat parts about it is four-player. Starts out right now with four different Vault Hunters, but you can have multiples of the same Vault Hunter in a game. Vault Hunters just kind of match up with your individual style. So again, it's a lot of fun. I've only put in about 60 hours on this game between me and some of my friends. We're at about 50% completion, but mind you, I tend to put a lot of time into finding everything I can in a game and a lot of time into leveling. One thing that is kind of interesting with this one is it does scale with levels, so you never quite reach that feeling of having godlike power. Instead, what you get to is a point where you start to learn behaviors and tactics of the enemies, and you'll have jumps in weapons as they get better and better. You'll also find a lot better options. It is an open world game. Unlike previous installments of the Borderlands series, there was Borderlands, Borderlands pre-sequel, Borderlands 2, Borderlands 3. Those were all pretty straightforward by way of storyline, or you started out the storyline, you played through, new levels opened up depending on where you were at in the game, and you just kind of went from A to B to C. They were a lot of fun. I played hundreds of hours across all of the installments. This one, as I said before, I'm 60 hours in, I'm halfway completed, and the world is huge. It's this big open expanse. The storyline is not quite as potent in this one. It's not quite as story driven. The storyline is still there. It's still fun. There's still a lot of very intriguing characters and areas to play in. It's just they opened it up into that exploration a lot more. Some really good things, some kind of bad things about it. I really enjoy the fact that I'm not locked in to run down this hallway for the 37th time. It opens it up a lot more than that. It's also a pretty seamless integration. You have three main areas in the game, and then a couple of think of them as sub-dungeons. So as I'm playing through the game, I have this huge map that I can run around with. I don't have any load screens. I don't have to worry about any of that. Where the enemies are changes a little bit. What enemies you're running across change. You have drop-ins from the Timekeeper's forces, who's kind of the antagonist of the game. You have bandits, of course, rippers. You have big buffalo-looking things called the Wild Horns. You have a wide variety of enemies that you're going to be going up against, and you can run across most of them in just about any area. It's set on Kairos. It's a new planet. One of the neat parts about what they did is you have those three main regions. Each of them has a little bit of a different feel. So one of them is more the dusty desert expanse. You have another one that is kind of a lush jungle forest. And then the last one is kind of snowy mountains. They feel different. When you load into one of them, you can tell, oh, I'm in this area or the other area. It's really kind of nice. It's a refreshing take on it. The first game, everything was pretty much desert. The antagonist, the Timekeeper, is fun. A little bit lacking for me. I yearn a bit for the days of Handsome Jack in Borderlands 2. The Timekeeper, with the storyline being a little more open, doesn't quite have the same pop as in some of the other ones because he's not as integral to the story. He's still there. The storyline is still there. It's just a little less immersive. The Timekeeper is pretty much a god, for lack of a better term. He is an extremely powerful being on the planet Kairos. He was in control for a very long time, and then a new moon broke its way into the planet, and things started to change. And you're a vault hunter that wakes up on Kairos and is trying to find the vault. And I don't want to ruin the story for you, but through story play, kind of learned a little bit more about it. As I mentioned in the beginning, it is still a looter shooter. For those of you who aren't familiar with it, that means that as you fight, enemies will drop weapons. You pick up the weapons and continue on your adventure, but the weapons are huge in this game. There are millions of combinations. You have various different manufacturers. Vladoff are known for medium power, but super high magazine rates and high rate of fire. You have Maliwan that do most of your status effects. You have Jacobs. Their guns are made out of freaking wood, was a line out of the first one. They are known for extremely high power, very small magazines, and depending on what your gameplay is really what kind of weapon you're going to look at using. Some people really like that faster rate of fire. Some like the really high accuracy where you only have to shoot them once. It depends on who you're playing with. Depending on what you like is going to depend on how you balance it off. My personal style, I use a lot of Maliwan because I really like elemental effects, but I still carry that Jacob sniper rifle because when I need to shoot him from a distance, I only want to have to shoot him once. So this one has a few less gun manufacturers for the base guns. But one of the things that it does that's a lot of fun is you have substitution parts. So I may pick up a Jacob sniper rifle, but it has a Maliwan aftermarket on it that allows me to shoot it with an elemental effect. Or torque is the explosive weapons. I may pick up a torque weapon that has the Hyperion force field when I aim down the sights. So you really get to cross around between them. One of the really neat parts, and I will admit I have not gotten up to this yet, but it was something that has been teased about in every installment of this game, is the fact that one of the things they wanted to do was have modifiable guns. So if I find that perfect weapon, high fire rate, beautiful power stat, whatever it may be, but it doesn't have the magazine I'm looking for, I could find a gun that has a better magazine and put it in. Well, this isn't quite that open, but you are supposed to be able to take these modified parts and switch them between guns. It will destroy the original gun, but you get that piece and you can put it onto the second one. This is seeing some fruition in this game. It's supposed to really open up being able to mix and match and really build the arsenal to your develop it to your gameplay style. One of the other fun parts is the enemies are fast. So you run across a lot of these, and either they're a little bit plodding or they're the same every time, so you know exactly what you're doing. They do a lot of interesting things with this one, where the enemies have special abilities. They will have different weapons. They will have all of these different components that make every fight seem like its own challenge. There's also a lot more badasses. Badass is kind of that next tier enemy, so it's a grunt who's just a lot better with more health and does more damage, or it's a ripper that does the same thing. They just make the game a little bit more interesting. They always have special abilities, and in this case, some of those get really wild to the point where I have an enemy that's normally susceptible to fire damage, and they'll have elemental eaters, so if I shoot them with fire damage, it heals them. So then you have to change tactics a little bit, make sure that you're using the right weapons for the right combat. it really adds that element of tactics to the game, which I feel is a lot of fun. And again, there are just so many weapons. You may find the same gun 8 times, and every time it looks a little bit different, and it feels a little bit different, and the stats are a little bit different, even though some of the main core parts are the same. And they're all beautiful. When you're looking down them, it's not that, oh, I found a rifle, and every type of rifle that I find is that same way. I may find 20 different torque shotguns, and each of them is going to look a little bit different and a little bit unique. And that holds through with gameplay. As I'm aiming down the sights, the scope is going to be different, or the reflex sight is a little bit different. Or the gun just looks a little bit different, which is really a neat component to it. Quick note on that, you can also skin weapons. And what I mean by that is there's a customization page where you can go in and you can actually give your weapons paint jobs. So if you have that special sniper rifle that you want to make hot pink and yellow, go for it. Make it hot pink and yellow and see what you can do for fun with it. There's also class mods and enhancements. So in Borderlands 3, you had artifacts and class mods. Class mods have been pretty much a staple since the beginning. One of the really cool parts about this is you get, for the enhancements, you get them from a manufacturer. So you, let's say Malawan. You get a really useful ability from Malawan. One of the ones that I got was, if I kill an enemy with elemental damage, they explode and cause elemental effects on enemies around them. That can be a game changer when you're running across hordes of enemies. And then it will give you a couple of additional bonuses. It may make your pistol stronger, or it may make your life better, or it may make your magazine size larger. All of these things, and you'll get anywhere from 1 to 3 of these special abilities. How you utilize those can really change the power level of your character and make it a lot more fun. One that I did, I play as Rafa. He's got twin cannons on his back that he uses. He has an exoskeleton. And one of the really neat parts, he has an ability that the more times I shoot someone, the more bonus damage I do. So I'm looking for that really high rate of fire. I'm looking for a really high magazine capacity. So that's what I aimed at. It means that when I'm dealing out damage, my bonus damage is going through the roof very quickly on a lot of enemies, and I can sustain that damage without having to reload, which resets it. So you have this kind of thing that you can really look at and really play with. One thing that I did want to mention again is that it is almost too big an open world for some of this. You can get kind of lost running around in the world trying to find that perfect gun or trying to find that perfect fight or trying to find all the little side quests and things like that. This really is a lot of fun, really immersive. It's the type of game that I turn on. I'm like, oh, I've got 20 minutes to play before bed, and all of a sudden I'm 2 hours late to go to bed. But if you're really story-driven, you kind of have to keep on track for going through just what you want to look at. By way of some of the details, not super linked into gameplay, the soundtrack is really quite fun. And one of the things that I like about it is it doesn't super jump out at you. It doesn't overrun combat. It doesn't really captivate you, but it is good for channeling the gameplay itself. When you get into combat, you feel your pulse go up and the soundtrack changes a little bit, or the exploration has some really nice kind of soothing music to go along with it. It really is an excellently well-done soundtrack. The graphics are all pretty good. As I said before, I played on Xbox, and the Xbox graphics were nice. They were smooth. They still have that Borderlands aesthetic, which you can tell that it's a cartoon. But the movement in it is really good. The scenery looks lovely. You can actually go swimming in this one, which is a bit of a change, so the water dynamics are a little bit different. All right. One thing that I did want to throw out that I feel does need to be touched on. The first game was pretty ribald and pretty graphic, and then they kind of toned it down for the next couple of them. Still definitely some innuendo, still some... I mean, you're running around shooting people, so it's not completely violence-free. This one has a lot more graphic violence and is much coarser on the language. The reason I want to mention that, it doesn't bother me necessarily, but it does let me know that if I'm watching it with a small child in the room, we need to be aware of that so that we can make that judgment on if that's something we want to expose them to. Instead of shooting somebody and they fall down, you, in this one, you get things like spray on the wall or limbs get blown off and things like that. So it can be a little more over the top. And again, that language can be a little more coarse than in some of the previous installments. So all in all, I really have enjoyed this game. For me to be able to devote 60 hours and only be halfway through, for me, definitely make sure that that game is worthwhile. I've been a huge fan of the series as well as the genre since it came out. I remember waiting in a GameStop store at midnight to get the first one when it first released, because I was that much looking forward to it, and I have kept that same enthusiasm all the way through. If you look on some of the rating sites, you're going to see it rated anywhere from a low to a high 8. For me, I'm going to give it 9 out of 10 hammers by way of things that I've played in the last year or so. This has been one of the best experiences I've had. Again, it does have a couple of flaws going on. It does have some things that I wish might have been a little bit different, but at the same time, the positives really make up for that. Well, I really hope that people have fun playing this game as much as I did. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to drop them on our website, thevault.show. So feel free to come on, drop your comments. I love to read them, and I will do my best to address some here in the near future. Well, thank you everyone for your time, and I hope to talk to you again soon. Bye.
So you've heard what James thinks. Let us know what you think. Do you like Borderlands 4? Do you agree with his review? Disagree? Go to userfriendly.show and let us know. And speaking of reviews of things, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about Snafu. Bill, I'm going to throw this to you. If you could tell us what Snafu is for anybody that doesn't know and what your feeling was on attending.
Well, as we've covered previous years, it's Sierra Nevada Anime Fans United Convention. And it's held at the Reno Sparks Convention Center. And this is another year that happened over Halloween weekend. It was a 3-day event, and it just had a lot of fun there. Lots of guests.
It's usually Halloween, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it has been for a couple of years now.
I remember, but it's been a number of years since I've been to it, but that was the case. So you said it was a lot of fun. What did you think?
I really enjoyed it. I spent a lot of time in tabletop gaming, which was one of the things they had available, playing some Dungeons & Dragons and the new Final Fantasy 14 tabletop RPG, which was quite a lot of fun.
I've never even heard of that. That sounds amazing.
Huh. Yeah.
Yeah, I hadn't either. It slipped under my radar. But they had Call of Cthulhu, and they had some other things. But, you know, gaming isn't the forefront to Snafu. It's the anime, which they have plenty of different panels and guests, voice actors, cosplayers, and just a lot of fun, even on main stage, having various games. Like, they had one that was named that Pokemon.
Let me ask you a question about this, because there's been some feedback that we've seen here on the show and other places that this convention was getting a little, let's say, long in the teeth. Do you think that they're still looking good? Are they fresh, or is it getting stale?
I think they had a rough patch last year, especially. I think they are getting better. They're under new management, and I think they are finding themselves to be where they need to be in this community. Because it is a small convention. You know, it's not the smallest convention I went to, which was at an American Legion hall, and it was about 10 vendors.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Wow, no, that's even smaller than the Sands event.
Yeah.
Yes, remember that?
It was smaller than the Sands event. Really was.
Although I got wow. So Sands is a casino in Reno, Nevada that held a Comic-Con that I think was one day, and it was like in one of the convention rooms. Although I still had fun going to it. I enjoyed being there, but it was definitely tiny. You know, so but
is Snafu still like kid or teenager friendly? Because it seemed like the times that I had gone with Jeremy and I, we kind of noticed like, hey, we're the old people here, you know?
Very. It's an all ages, family oriented event.
That's cool. And does it still run like nonstop from start to finish?
Now that they're in the Reno Sparks Convention Center, they run until about 10:30 at night. They used to run full 24/7, but I decided that about 10 to 10 seems to be a good run time.
That I can see where, from a production standpoint, that's probably better. I thought it was kind of cool, though. You could get up at 3 in the morning and the convention was still open and on, and there were people there. But in those days, it was at a casino, which is designed for 24-hour, you know, around-the-clock stuff. And I can see, you know, the convention center being different. But
I still have the drawings that I volunteered in my costume to be the subject of drawings because they had like a little area. I guess I'm not really sure whether you would call it a panel or a special project. But anyways, they had everybody sitting in like a horseshoe shape where the drawers would do their artwork. And I still have the pictures from that. So, yeah, that was kind of fun.
I guess they call that a workshop now.
A workshop? Okay. I guess it depends on where you go. So what is the difference, really, between an anime convention and something like a Comic-Con? I know there's some similarities, but cosplayers and stuff, but there's some big differences, too.
The focus is on anime, you know, Japanese animation, Korean animation, Chinese animation. It's very much more focused on that than, say, Marvel or DC, or a lot of comic conventions now have a crossover where they're adding anime and manga, but they are very focused here with an anime convention. So that's why they have, you know, voice actors and different things like that that are very specific to that genre.
Do they go to the extent of restricting like the cosplayers and stuff to fit into that genre, or can you just go show up in your Chewbacca costume, or would that matter?
You can show up in whatever. They really don't, you know, try and control that by any means. They do have requirements, you know, no showing too excessive skin or things like that, because it is a family event. Other events, you know, other conventions have different rules, but that's one of the ones that Snafu holds on for family stuff.
No, and that stuff like that totally makes sense. Yeah, the reason I ask is we had a couple of questions come in from one that was held somewhere in the Midwest. I'd have to look and see what the name of it was earlier in the year, but they were actually turning cosplayers away at the door if you weren't dressed in what they considered to be anime. And this caused a huge, you know, pushback. It really didn't sit well, and I can kind of understand that, you know, with people that are paying guests. And, well, we're not going to let you in because you're not dressed right. Well, I'm in my street clothes. Well, that's okay, you know, so. I was just curious if that was something that was common to anime or just to this one convention and nobody else does it, or, you know.
Must have been to that one convention.
Okay. Gretchen, can you imagine showing up at a Comic-Con and like a Star Wars thing and they wouldn't let you in the gate because you didn't meet some requirement?
I'd be annoyed. I'd be really annoyed because, not to be arrogant, but a lot of my costumes are pretty decent. Yeah, it's like, and, hey,
at the end of the day, I'll tell you. All right. Well, that's it for this week. Until next week, this is User Friendly 2.0, keeping you safe on the cutting edge.
User Friendly 2.0, copyright 2013 to 2025 by User Friendly Media Group Incorporated. All rights reserved. Content is the opinion of the show's participants and not necessarily this station or platform. Requests for material use, interviews, CCPA, privacy notice for California residents, GDPR information for UK and EU residents, and any other feedback may be submitted at userfriendly.show. We welcome your input. Thank you for listening.